Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast where you come for the jokes and stay for the economic analysis. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, this is our podcast on the budget. Now, interesting with the budget, Steve, it was the other way around, in that we all came to Philip Hammond for the economic analysis, but we stayed for the jokes.
Spreadsheet Phil thinks he's got a sense of humour.
I saw a Labour MP say he's never seen a best man speech at a funeral before.
Oh, that is vicious. Take down.
As I believe the young people call it, that is a sick burn.
Never do that again.
Actually, the best thing about the budget probably was the jokes. There was quite a good one about Jeremy Clarkson not liking driverless cars, but it's not the first time it's been snubbed by Hammond and May. But we're going to stay away from the jokes for this one, and instead, we're going to have a look at what's actually in the budget. Steve, what is the main thing that people need to know about the budget then?
I think I'll start actually with what seems to be leading the headlines this morning and listen to the news on the radio. So I listened to not BBC Radio 4.
Very sensible. I heard John Humphreys trying to understand economics and it wasn't a pretty sight.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of the reasons I don't listen to Radio 4 in the mornings. I listen to Absolute FM, and one of the things it led off with was stamp duty. But that's probably not the most relevant point out of it. It's the most relevant point of the budget is that we're not hitting that deficit reduction target till 2025.
It's competing with HS2 to be the government project, which is most going to be over time. I think the biggest takeaway actually is the downgrading of both growth and of productivity,
which is linked massively into those deficit reduction targets as well.
It's almost like you need to have investment in the economy for it to grow, and then you might be able to hit a deficit reduction target.
Yeah, it's almost like if you weren't also spending all of your time arguing about Brexit, you might actually be able to focus on those issues as well.
It's weird because when we had our budget predictions, we tried to make it a bit of an either-or. We said, well, either Philip Hammond will stick very rigidly to austerity, or he will rip up the fiscal rules and tear up the deficit reduction targets. In the end, he didn't do either, and we did suggest there might be a bit of a fudge on housing. In fact, there was a bit of a fudge on housing, so the headline figure was £44 billion being spent on housing.
That £44 billion, you know, whilst it's welcome, but what we're actually seeing here is only £15.3 billion is actually new money. You know, that's still significant amounts, don't get me wrong. But of that money, a lot of it isn't the government just spending money to build houses. It's making money available for local authorities to then borrow, which will then be paid back at a later point. Now, I can see why the government might have done this. It's a nice way, potentially, to get local authorities to act, saying, here is that pot. But it also, you know, it doesn't mean the government's having to borrow for it, or they're going to have to borrow on the market for it.
It doesn't add to government debt.
Yeah,
either.
Exactly. In and of itself, it's a small minor tweak. That 300,000 homes being built per year is ambitious and the kind of level we need to be getting at a minimum. Mm-hmm. So it's good that the government is seemingly at least moving towards that, but I don't think it's enough. Amongst some of the details around the house building policies, there are a few other bits and pieces which are relevant to this area, which haven't necessarily been focused on that much, as far as I can see. And the main one being that local authorities are going to be able to double council tax on empty homes, which is absolutely fascinating from a political perspective. Absolutely sure the government is quite happy that it's not being talked about, because an awful lot of the people who own those second homes, which may very well be empty, are going to be government supporters in one way or another. And the fact that they're doing it, let's say it's local authorities can do it, well, that means that the Tory authorities don't have to do it, and the Labour authorities can do it, and then the Tories can try and whack them for it in elections. But again, that actually as a policy and giving authorities the ability to do that is quite welcome. But again, for the most part, it's fiddling around the edges. Whilst we like to think that in London there are vast, you know, troughs of properties which are lying vacant, in reality there aren't that many. There are certainly some which are definitely being bought up by foreign millionaires, but for the most part, you know, most things aren't lying vacant.
Quick quiz for you. Which housing policy was also in Labour's housing plan in the June election?
Why, that would be the stamp duty policy.
Okay, second question. Which policy is it that was singled out for criticism by the OBR?
That would be the stamp duty policy.
Mm. The stamp duty, as we were saying before we recorded this, is one of those fascinating policies which is probably both terrible yet popular.
Yeah, there were some fascinating figures that I found online from, I think it was YouGov, which listed out all of the various taxes. Now, perhaps unsurprisingly, the most unfairly viewed tax was inheritance tax, but coming close behind that was stamp duty. 48% viewed stamp duty as being an unfair tax. And one of the first things that I found was an article on Money Saving Expert, which is Martin Lewis's website. This is why stamp duty is an unfair tax. When even individuals such as Martin Lewis, who is not in any way a Tory shill, are happy to say, actually, this tax has problems. Really, there's a lot of potential political gain to be made from reforming this. That's not to say that the reform that they're going to do is going to be effective, and it would not surprise me if in a couple of weeks I went back onto the Money Saving Expert website and found an article from Martin Lewis saying, actually, this reform isn't that good.
Maybe, to paraphrase Martin Luther King, the arc of the universe is long and slow, but does bend towards the abolition of unpopular taxes.
Yes.
And the reason apparently it seems to be such a terrible policy is because it gives more cash to these people who are quite wealthy already if they're selling the house for, say, I think 350k is the limit, isn't it? The maximum amount it would be abolished for. So you would essentially give the householder another 20, 30 grand on top that they already get.
And the other side of that, though, is the fact that the stamp duty reform is designed to incentivize people to buy. It's basically saying you're not going to pay this tax. Therefore get more people involved and actually out there looking at the market and buying homes. The problem is we don't have enough supply. So when you have increased demand and the same amount of supply, prices go up. That is basic economics. What the OBR is saying is that what you'll see is any money that would likely be saved for buyers from the reduction in stamp duty will be counterbalanced by the fact that the price is going to go up probably by about a very similar level or to a very similar level. Now, I've seen some interesting things from the Adam Smith Institute kind of saying, actually, inherently, it's probably better that that extra money goes to the sellers rather than the government, because, you know, it means there's more money to be invested back into various things.
I'm shocked the Adam Smith Institute is not in favour.
I know. The core problem here is that it doesn't actually make home ownership cheaper. It's a minor fudge which isn't really going to do anything.
So minor fudge that doesn't really do anything just reminds me of Liam Fox. But before we started recording, we were talking about a friend, actually, who listens to the podcast, so shout out to Lisa, who was talking about how the budget feels like it's not really an example of joined-up government. It feels like it's a response to the various political crises that the government is in. So this isn't exactly what she was arguing, but it's kind of taken from what she was saying. For instance, there's a massive problem for the Tories on NHS spending, hence there's more money going into the NHS. Not quite as much as the as was wanted by NHS chiefs, but there's money going in. Brexit is wanting money for a no-deal Brexit, so there's £3 billion going to preparations for no deal. Again, it's not as much money as you need, but it's going there. You need more money going to schools, so there's money which is being set aside, as Philip Hammond said, to give the nation a good time by investing in training maths teachers. Again, one of the things we said on last week's podcast was, if you want to attract good maths teachers, it's not about paying them more, you also have to make it a better working environment, but we'll park that. Universal credit is an even more massive problem for the poor sods who are being forced onto it at the moment, but it's a massive political problem with the government, with its own backbenchers as well. Hence, you saw reforms on universal credit there. However, you didn't see any more money going into social care, which is surely going to be a massive problem over the next year. As we said, the funding's gone down by 5% into social care. I can't believe that they've managed to overlook that.
Yeah, I mean, what you're also seeing is a failure, despite kind of talking up new devolution deals. The West Midlands is getting a new devolution deal, including various powers on a number of different areas, primarily, I think, transport and home building. But no conversation there about tax raising powers or the ability to raise more revenue in that in the West Midlands or in any of the other regions, which links directly to the social care or lack of funding that exists, because the social care is handled by local authorities. And really, to fix the social care crisis that we are seeing, we need more funding to go into it. And what you're seeing there is a kind of a classic example of looking at all of the different trees but missing the forest, kind of like focusing on in each individual area but not seeing that they're all interconnected. In the budget, we've got a focus on house building. Okay, that's fine. The extra money for the NHS, good, welcome. But that doesn't necessarily solve the problem that a number of people, when they leave hospital, need social care. You know, the wider situation isn't helped because that social care isn't there. And that social care problem underlines an awful lot of other areas. One of the reasons we end up running out of beds in the NHS is because people don't have anywhere to go. Again, lack of social care, which puts more pressures on the NHS. So there's a number of different areas here where the government is just failing to see that these two different areas are connected and not acting on it.
Hmm. You can tell it's a bit of a fudge. Philip Hammond is trying to save his job. He's trying to balance the competing interests of so many different groups of people. And we said on Sunday, it was an almost impossible task, and he's done almost as well as you could do when, well, considering the fact that this is a government that doesn't, for all that Theresa May seemingly wants a legacy beyond Brexit and wants her own mandate to fix the things that she needs fixing with Britain, she's just not in a position to do anything radical.
No, I mean, this was very much a budget lacking vision. There were so many areas where they could have been radical, even if it was something just amongst, say, the Brexit front. Yeah, yes, there's extra money going in to fund Brexit preparations, but $3 billion, it's not that much in the scale of what's going to be needed. I mean, we talked on a previous podcast about how much you'd need for just the customs officials. And, yeah. And you know, we need to buy that land. We need to hire those people, train those people, manage those people. And that's just one area, never mind, you know, all of the other potential things that we need to look at. You would have expected the government, if they were going to go radical on something, and just basically gone, okay, we're just going to put more money into this area. One, it keeps the backbenchers really, really happy. And two, it's actual sensible thing to do if we are actually looking to leave the customs union and the single market, because we need to do those things anyway. But instead, we don't have that. Instead, we've got, yet again, a nice little nod of the hat to the Brexiteers on the Tory backbenchers, but not actually enough to do it properly. Hmm. So we are seeing, even on the one issue where the government is supposed to have a clear vision, we know it doesn't, but where it'd be really easy and obvious for it to take an action which would keep you know, their backbenchers happy and be a sensible step, which even most commentators could go, well, if we're going to leave, yeah, that makes sense. They've not even done that.
It's the worst kind of bluff. It's almost like trying to convince their opponents they have a revolver in their breast pocket when the opponent already knows it's a spoon.
Yeah, pretty much. It is very similar to that sort of situation.
And actually, in terms of the structural problems and the that are not going to be fixed by this budget, apparently NHS chiefs are going to be meeting, I think, either this week or next week, talking about, can we deliver universal healthcare? Can the NHS actually afford to provide all the services that it does currently? Mm-hmm. Or do they have to introduce some sort of rationing? And that will, well, for the first time since 1948, mean they will have to ration health services to people. Massive, you'd have thought, massive news hasn't really been covered. Instead, the Daily Mail put a picture of Philip Hammond on its front page and said that he's no longer a cartoon donkey.
Yeah, I mean, it is, in many ways, quite interesting how the media seems to be covering this. I mean, some of the papers have been covering this as though it's the end of austerity. Others have been kind of covering this as though it's all about Philip Hammond. Others are focused on stamp duty. Others are focused on the house building aspects. All in all, there's an awful lot of different ways that this is being taken, which from the government's perspective is a good thing, because it means there isn't a single narrative being built in a negative way. at the moment, treading water and keeping their head above the water is exactly what they need to do. As George Osborne's budgets post the coalition showed, it's very easy for them to go tits up and to have just one or two policies just kind of overtake everything else that's in there.
As Hammond's budget did last year as well.
Yeah, with the national insurance rises for self-employed people. Yeah.
And, I mean, I did make the prediction semi-seriously on last week's show that I did think it would completely unravel within a week. I don't think that will happen, which obviously now I've predicted that means it will. It
obviously will happen, yeah.
But it is a safety-first budget of a government that wants to get from one side of the road to the other without crapping itself.
Pretty much, yeah.
Let's not talk too much about the wider politics of Philip Hammond's job, because we're going to have a midweek shot out about a reshuffle and why May just doesn't sack Boris. One thing we haven't talked about that maybe is a little bit radical, but I know is close to your heart. We've talked about schools, mm-hmm. About my area of interest, but there was some stuff on tech issues and electric cars that you found quite interesting in the budget.
Yeah, I mean, some of the tech stuff was pretty standard. You know, there was money being made available for digital skills training and that sort of stuff. You know, the sort of things that really, I think, have been in every budget for the past probably decade or so. But there were two things which really stood out for me. Number one, and this is just quite a nice little thing because it shows how seriously the government is taking this technology, that they're making $400 million available for electric car charging points. I read something online which said that there was either they were looking at or there was going to be some form of regulation that said that all new builds would need to have the ability to have a car charging point set up in them as well. So, you know, all in all, if we're talking about tackling climate change, decreasing our CO2 emissions, that's a quite an interesting and strong move from the government. Is it enough? Probably not, but it's a step in the right direction. The other thing, though, that I found absolutely fascinating was the fact that $75 million has been found to fund research and PhDs into areas that concern artificial intelligence. Now, AI is one of those research areas which has the potential to define probably the mid to late part of this century. We, you know, when we talk about you know, economic revolutions, we talk about the agricultural, the industrial, the digital revolution. To be quite honest, when we start talking about automating jobs and things like that, that only happens once we've got artificial intelligence up to standard. And as much as we like to, it gets talked up now, really, it's not there yet. So the fact that the government is investing in this area is a clear sign of their recognition that this is something which is going to be very important to the economy moving forward. Is $75 million enough to do that? No. Is the short answer, to be honest. When you look at what the primarily Southeast Asian countries are actually investing in these fields, it's vastly, vastly superior in terms of amounts of money being invested into AI. Now, fair enough. Now, I'm sure Philip Hammond would say, well, actually, austerity, we've only got so much money, you know, we've just had a downgrade of growth and productivity and all of those things. But really, if we want to be able to position the UK as an economic leader in various fields moving forward, and this is the time right now where we should be investing in them, because it is work done now and in the coming decades which is going to define where we are economically in the future. And to be honest, this is a nice little step forward, but it's not sufficient.
And it's a shame that our Brexit policy is destroying universities, the fact that foreign students don't want to come here, the fact that academics don't want to come here. Also, artificial intelligence, I feel like I just ought to insert a generic joke about the Maybot. So if we can just take that as read.
Cool, that's lovely. Fine.
One thing that was trailed, and it's interesting in terms of the trailing before the budget, just as the budget itself wasn't exactly a trailblazer, the pre-budget briefing wasn't exactly the most exciting it could have been. And one policy that was trailed, as well as the training of maths teachers, was what I think was a Lib Dem policy on taxing plastic.
Well, I'm not sure if it's literally a Lib Dem the Dem policy, but it is very similar, obviously, in vein to the plastic bag tax, which was brought in under the coalition, which was Lib Dem policy.
Well, wasn't there then a proposition, I think, at least to say, well, we're taxing bags work, so now we'll try plastic cups?
There may very well have been. There was definitely a plastic cup thing which was mentioned, but I think in some ways, actually, what the government's done here is extended it beyond that. A lot of what I've seen this kind of tagged up as a takeaway tax, because it's looking at the plastic containers that you get your kebabs in or you get your curries in and things like that. But it also does include, as you say, cups. It also includes toothpaste and things like that. So it's basically anything you buy which uses plastic as it's in its container, there's a potential for us to be taxed on it. Which, from an environmental standpoint, you can see the logic. From a revenue-raising standpoint, you can see the logic. My one thought is just, they're about to spend an awful lot of money debating what constitutes as plastic and what doesn't. Because there are an awful lot of things. Again, going back to those drinks cups from Starbucks or whatever, where they are partly plastic, but they're also partly paper. And we're going to spend an awful lot of time arguing about what constitutes a plastic cup. Wow. In the same way that we spent God knows how long in the courts arguing about whether Jaffa cakes were biscuits.
That is an exciting podcast for 2018. I'm sure our listeners won't be able to get enough.
I know, it's going to be amazing.
I just like to think that Philip Hammond watched Blue Planet 2 on the BBC at 9 o'clock and saw what was happening in the seas with all the plastic and went, no, we need to do something about this. And there's a completely rewrote his budget in a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, next year we'll just get some stronger policy on microbeads as well. And
as we said, we've got a midweek shot out in the week. We have a website, notenoughchampagne.com, and a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Please like us, share us, subscribe to us, talk about us with your friends and your family. Our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram, and Dave Depper put together our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. My Twitter handle is Paperback Rioter.
Mine is @CentreRadical.
Happy plotting.